Welcome to the latest episode of the Custom Private Equity Podcast, Private Equity in the 1970s. Today we will talk with Paul Anthony Thomas, the principal at CustomPrivateEquity.com. I'm Ron Davis, experienced podcaster, and I'll be asking all the newbie questions. Well, Paul, last time we started a series, sort of, going through the decades of your career. We started with the 60s, and so I'm assuming today we're going to do the 70s.
Thank you for being here today, Ron. We're going to do the 70s today. We're going to talk about where private equity was in the 70s and what it was and what it wasn't and what it morphed into. And we're just going to have kind of a brief discussion about it.
All right. So why don't you give us a quick introduction to private equity again, and then tell us what the 70s was like.
So we consider private equity to be an investment by any individual or company of private money into a private offering or a private deal of some kind. So buying a piece of real estate is a private deal in general. Buying stock in a new company or a new corporation is a new venture type thing. So in the 70s, the venture world actually started, and we saw the upshot or the starting up of Silicon Valley and Menlo Park and that kind of area of the world. And the 70s were a great decade of advancement and change, but the economy was kind of stagnant. So the economy was sitting back on its heels. We had a very large recession early in the 70s when the Saudi oil embargo happened in 73, caused a huge recession. Not too different than the COVID recession that we've seen. It was a huge recession. And the price of energy went up fourfold during the decade, which caused inflation to go up dramatically, but unemployment was up dramatically as well. The people were laid off because they had recessions. It was a very unusual time. But we had, during this time, there were great technical advances. So the term became known as stagflation, and we had high levels of inflation. Unemployment was high at the same time. So normally high inflation and high unemployment do not go together, because high inflation is generally viewed as the economy is booming and things are happening and interest rates are going up lots of things are happening in the economy. But this economy was actually stagnant because which caused unemployment to be high. So it was a very unusual economic time during almost the entire decade. We had two pretty good sized recessions during the decade, and there was one in 73 and another one in 77. So we had the Cold War. It was beginning to wind down. The Vietnam War actually ended in 75, so right in the middle of the decade. In politics, Richard Nixon was in his second term, and then he had to leave office. And then Gerald Ford took his place, and then Jimmy Carter was elected towards the end. The world population was about 4 billion people. Interest rates fluctuated between 5% and 12.5%, so the interest rates during the decade were going up. We had landed on the moon in 69, but Apollo 13 went to space in 72, 73 time frame, and barely made it back after one circle. They had a major malfunction. The first Earth Day happened. The EPA was created in 1970. Love Canal Superfund site happened in the 1970s, which was one of the instigators of the EPA. One of the major things that happened in science was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty happened, which 40-some-odd countries signed this, saying that we will make no more nuclear weapons. And that was a huge thing towards the end of the decade.
What was the world like, I don't know, from a cultural point of view in the 70s?
Well, the most popular movies of the 70s were Jaws, was one of the big ones. One of Steven Spielberg's first shows. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Close Encounters, American Graffiti was huge, Animal House. The first Star Wars movie came out in 77. Carrie was a big hit. French Connection, that was an automobile movie where they had lots of auto races, auto chases in that show. Last Picture Show was interesting. The first Godfather came out. Disco became huge. Staying Alive, Travolta's first film, major film, came out. And Grease came out in 78. Music, Paul McCartney left the Beatles. That broke up. Michael Jackson, the Jackson 5 were huge. They were one of the largest groups of the 70s. Motown was at its height. We saw Simon and Garfunkel reach their peak, the Rolling Stones, Zeppelin, AC/DC, Black Sabbath. So hard rock was coming into play, ABBA. So that was kind of a light rock. The Beach Boys were huge. Creedence was a big player in the 70s. Creedence was a big player in the 70s, and the Bee Gees were in their heyday during that period of time. So the popular TV shows of the decade were Little House, Kojak, The Brady Bunch, All in the Family, Monty Python, which was interesting, Dukes of Hazzard. Daisy Duke was one of the most popular stars of the decade, actually. Lassie, Happy Days, Odd Couple, Saturday Night Live premiered, HBO and cable became very, very popular during this period of time. Actually, during that period of time, you could actually build a cable system and double your money in a very short period of time. You could build a system and sell it to somebody and they would pay you twice as much as it cost to build it. WTBS became the largest superstation, the first superstation in North America. Ted Turner became tremendously wealthy off that. And most of his wealth on that was generated from the infomercial. So he actually financed that entire operation of selling products on the TV through infomercials. In science, the Concorde made its first supersonic faster than the speed of sound flight from New York to Paris during that decade.
And what did the investing world look like?
Well, as I said earlier, the economy was stagnant. The Dow ranged from 600 to 900, so it only fluctuated about 300 points during the decade. Had recessions in the beginning and the end. Had a large recession in 73, another large recession in 77. So we saw bear markets throughout the decade. Stagflation was the term used in the decade. The Dow at the end of 1979 was trading right at 900. Today is trading at 27,000. So that gives you an idea of what inflation's looked like over the last 40 years. $100 in 1970 today is worth $670. So we've had a 670% increase in the last 40 years. Average new house cost was $58,000. Today it's $145,000. Average income was about $17,000 a year towards the end of the decade. Average rent somewhere between $140 and $250 a month. The first 747 flight took place during that decade. So last decade we had the 737, and this decade we had the 747, which was designed to carry twice as many people. The first Intel 4004 processor came out, which led to the creation of the Radio Shack 80 computer, TRS-80. That was my first personal computer. The Apple II, I had one of those as well. Commodore, what we called the Commodore PET came out, and the Atari 400 and 800 series both came out. So bulletin boards became very popular. The beginning of email started back then. ARPANET actually started in the 60s, and then email kind of started coming out. And you saw some launching of some bulletin boards. The one I used was CompuServe, and I also had an AOL account as well. So barcodes were introduced. The inkjet printer was actually designed and created. The first laser printers were actually designed, but they didn't become popular until the next decade. Skylab was started. The microwave oven was introduced. Microsoft was founded in 75. Apple was founded in 76. The Alaskan pipeline opened. The first MRI was done, magnetic resonance imaging, which is used frequently today. The first test tube baby was born, a woman named Louise Brown. Very interesting. Belize and the Bahamas became independent from the United Kingdom. Three Mile Island happened, which was the first North American nuclear disaster. The Walkman was introduced. It was a cassette player you put on your belt. Initial IPOs for that year, Applied Materials, Family Dollar had its initial public offering in the late 1970s. Intel was founded. The race to make the best chip was on after Intel created its 4004 chip. Lennar was created, IPO for Lennar, which is a home builder. Pier 1, Walmart did its IPO in the 70s. ERISA, which was the federal government act to create the regulatory framework around pension funds, was created. So that was a big deal. Popular stocks of the day, Avon, Bristol Myers, IBM, PepsiCo, Pfizer, Philip Morris, a big cigarette company, Polaroid, no longer exists. Walmart was a big company. Texas Instruments was huge. Schlumberger, Walt Disney. The Bass Brothers from the mid-70s to the mid-80s made over $5 billion in then Walt Disney stock. Coke, Dow, Deck, General Electric, Gillette was huge. Kodak, which is no longer around. Johnson & Johnson. And one of our favorite stocks during that time was Pitney Bowes, was a growth stock.
You know, you mentioned owning a TRS-80. I often like to tell the story that my father made the best investment of his entire life when he spent $2,500, and this is in 1970s money, to buy me an Apple II. I love that thing and gave me a 20-year career as a computer programmer during this whole time. What did that computer cost my dad?
So yeah, $20,000.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of amazing. I'm calling dad tonight and telling him thank you again. Right. And the idea that was like, oh my gosh, you can have computers in your house. They cost $28,000. What was private equity like back then?
Well, it's interesting. The stock market crashed 73, 74, and we had a recession in 70, 77. But during the 70s, private equity morphed into the venture world with an onslaught of Apple and Microsoft and the onslaught of Silicon Valley and Menlo Park and the creation of the semiconductor and putting creation of silicone chips. And because of the recessions, gold returned a 31% return during that decade. Real estate investment trusts were actually launched in the mega millions of dollars, and they had a 16% average annual return. So the returns were high for the right companies. Management buyouts were formalized. Last time we talked about leveraged buyouts, and now we're talking more about venture capital and management buyouts, where a management team will go in and say, I want to buy this company. The original owners are starting to retire. And then young managers want to buy the company. So we've started manager buyouts. The leverage buyouts in the 70s were basically based in more in the middle market, more in the $25 million company to $250 million company. That's where the Wall Street people broke into the business, is buying smaller companies and rolling them up into conglomerates. If you look at the entire stock market, the leverage buyouts only made up about 20% of the total merger. Some notable startups during Microsoft: Tandem Computers, Genentech, which is a scientific company, Apple, went for venture capital funding in 1978, Compaq Computers, and Federal Express. Fred Smith, actually, after 9 attempts of starting his company, he finally got enough venture funding to actually get his company off the ground. And he'd been working on that for 20 some odd years before the late 1970s, when Federal Express actually got launched and got started.
So we talked a little about sort of the way companies were acquired in the 60s. So what were some of the items that are used today that started showing up in this capital stack that emerged during the same era?
So one of the common features today that we use is a thing called mezzanine debt, which is a short-term loan to breach the difference between the permanent loan, which is put into a company like a bank would put in a permanent loan, and the amount of equity that an entrepreneur has to bring his company public. So the mezzanine piece is called mezzanine debt, and it's the high-yield debt market started towards the end of the 70s. We see convertible debt and equity when a company will issue a debt offering, but they say they attach to that debt offering, we have the right to turn this into equity if we want to. So they can actually buy a piece of the company by loaning the company money. Common versus preferred equity is a common part of the capital stack today. So when I talk about capital stack, I'm talking about the bank loan to buy a company is just like the bottom piece, but then you start stacking capital providers, the mezzanine debt and the preferred equity and the preferred debt, and then you do this equity and other types of equity, and so you have this pancake stack of money that's being provided by different people to buy out a company, and that's one of the large pieces of the leverage So you leverage this company up a lot by borrowing money from five different people in five different ways with five different payback modes. And so another thing that was brought to bear in the 70s is called the carried interest, which is how I make my money today. If I put a deal together, I'm gonna raise the money from investors, and then I'm gonna get a carried interest in the deal for bringing the idea, doing the research, and managing the deal. And a common typical structure for that back in the 70s and 80s was a 220 fund, where you get a 2% management fee and 20% of the profits. There's lots of versions of that structure today, but that structure still stands today.
So what is high yield debt? You talked a little about it, but I've not heard that term, the subordinated or high yield debt.
So high yield debt is a bond. So Milken made this popular in the early 80s, and he was a Drexel protege, and he would go out and sell bonds that were rated BB or below. And those bonds carried an interest rate of 12.5%. So if the investor would be promised a 12.5% return if he would buy that bond and give the money to the company. So those are high yield bonds when the bank was getting 6%.
Right. Idea was those grades that you were just giving them, A is great. And then as the letter gets higher, the likelihood that you're never going to get paid goes up, right?
Right. The quality of the repayment mode goes down as you go from A to B to C to D.
Right. So they were trading risk for a higher rate of return.
Higher yield, yes. Yeah. So that's why they were called high yield bonds. They were bonds issued by the company. So Microsoft, they issued some high yield bonds whenever they were launching their DOS-based products. So that's how these companies gather money together to go make things happen. So.
And are those instruments, when they use them, are they using it because they need money right now, so they're willing to pay more for it, and maybe they don't last as long, the bonds?
The bonds are generally short-term bonds that usually, in the beginning, they were 5 years or less, and the money goes to help the company grow, and the company needs the money now. Yes, that's correct. But they put a higher yield on the bonds because the company doesn't have enough infrastructure, doesn't have enough assets to do a standard bond or a high grade bond, like an A or a B bond. But back in the 70s, a 12% high yield bond was kind of middle of the road, high yield bond. I saw bonds in the 18% range, saw some bonds during that period of time in the 24% range. So if somebody came at you as an investor and said, I've got a bond that'll pay you 24%, you start reading the fine print and looking for the risk, because that is an extremely high risk investment on your part.
Right. Yeah, I think that nowadays people don't realize what interest rates were for everything back then. In the 70s, you know, I don't know, you want to go buy a house today. I'm not positive about this. I haven't got a mortgage in a while, but it's like, what, 3, 4% right now?
That's right. It's less than 3% now.
And what would it have been in the 70s?
Anywhere from 12 to 15.
Yeah. Can you imagine a 12 to 15 on a 30-year loan?
Yeah, that's, you're going to pay twice as much for the house with a 12% loan. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So who were some of the players in the 70s in this field?
Well, Warren Buffett was big, and I just love Warren Buffett's practices and the way he worked. He actually bought public companies. He bought large stakes in Coca-Cola. He bought large stakes in Geico, the insurance company you see all over the place today. Thomas Lee was a big player. He actually was working in the private equity world in the late 60s, but he didn't actually form his first fund until the mid 70s. He runs that fund today, multi-billion dollar fund. Colbert Kravis, they were Bear Stearns exes. They left Bear Stearns and started their own firm. Bear Stearns was big in this business. We saw the rise of venture capital firms, people like Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia Capital, Sandhill Road, TA Associates, Menlo Ventures. These are, if you've been in the computer world at all, you've heard all these names. Seven Rosen. Sometimes these people were called corporate raiders because they would go in and conduct hostile takeovers, became very common in the 70s. People would make tender offers. A stock would be selling at $70, and a corporate raider would come in and offer $80 a share and nobody would care because it was $10 more a share, and they would buy, you know, 75% of the company for $80 a share, and then they would actually own that company.
You know, when you say that they came in and they just offered 10, you know, given a little, we've talked in the past, but kind of how the stock market works, is there always enough shares for sale on the market to come in and buy a majority practice?
So there's a lot of times when a company will go public and they'll only offer 25% of the shares to the public. And then the president and CEO and chairman of the board own the rest, and the board members own the rest.
Two kind of questions came out of that. One was, can the company own its own stock and it not be owned by a person?
The answer to that question is yes, and that's called treasury stock.
And the other was, so in these corporate hostile takeovers where they came in and they just offered a higher price, they weren't necessarily doing that just on common stock that's on the market. They probably were offering that price to people who already owned large chunks of it, right?
They offered that, yes. Normally on a tender offer, they would identify the stockholders because there's a record of every stockholder and how many shares they own. So they would take 10 owners of a stock, and they would go to those owners directly before they ever made the tender offer and say, I want to buy this company and I'm going to pay you $80 a share. Will you tender your shares to me? So they would make that arrangement before they would ever tender out to the public to go buy a $70 stock for $80. So they would have control, basically, for all practical purposes, have control of the company before they ever made that tender offer to the public.
Right. Yeah. And I could see how this could be very dramatic behind the scenes, right? Like the first time you go to someone like that, so you say you go to a big pension fund that owns a big chunk of, let's say you're going to buy Apple, because we like to use Apple as a stock, as an example, even though these things don't happen to Apple. But if you were going to, you would go to some big pension fund that owns a bunch of Apple and you say, hey, I'll give you $10 more than what you could get for all of your shares if I would buy them. And they're like, okay, we'll take that because it's good for us, but we're also going to turn around and tell the people at Apple that you're getting ready to do this. And so this starts happening behind the scenes on both sides, right?
Right. So that was one of the huge deals. So if, say, somebody owned a million shares of Apple stock and there were a 20 million share flow, so they own 5% of the company, say a pension, say CalPERS owned 5% of Apple stock in the 1970s. And I went to CalPERS and I said, I want to buy your Apple stock at a tender offer, and I want you to tender your stock to me in this letter agreement. I want you to sign it, and I'll guarantee to, if you sign it, I'll guarantee to buy it and pay you $80 a share when it's trading today at 70. And then they would turn around and tell Apple, and the owners of Apple would put in what they call golden parachute clauses, and this happened a tremendous amount in the 80s. They would, that the chairman of the board and the board members would say, okay, if we get taken over in some sort of a tender offer or a hostile takeover, the board members are going to split $100 million of that, of the takeover money. If they would put in, that's called a golden parachute, they would go out to a bank and say, I need you to lend us $500 million to fend off this tender offer. So we're going to put $500 million in our bank account, and we're going to use that money to fend off this tender offer. And we're going to give you a first lien on all the assets that don't have debt against them today. So they would make the company less attractive by putting these things in place.
Right.
And there were lots of tender offers and lots of hostile takeovers that were fended off by these golden parachutes and these debt instruments that they put in place overnight.
So yeah.
They would call their banker and ask them for help, because we don't want Harold Simmons to own our company, because he's going to take it. He's going to take it and take it apart, sell off all the assets, raid our pension fund, and he's going to walk away with $500 million.
So what types of private equity were you dealing with in the 70s? Were you running around taking over other companies like that?
No, we weren't doing that. But the 70s, and part of the technical advances of the 70s, is that options started becoming actually a way to trade. There were options in the 60s on big companies like IBM, but in the 70s, smaller public companies started taking over the options, started issuing options on their stocks. So we went all the way down to companies that were worth $5 or $10 million, where they would actually issue options on their stock, and those options could be publicly traded. And we started learning about how to hedge our investments with stocks, and do calls and do covered calls and do swaps and do, we also started working in the Forex market. We were still doing oil and gas exploration. We did Wildcat wells. We created a pipeline business during that period of time. So I was running, when I got out of school in the 79, I was actually running on a natural gas pipeline for the first part of the 80s. That started in 1979. We were doing real estate developments. We were managing real estate. We did our commodities futures trading. The Forex options and foreign exchange markets, we worked in the Japanese yen, we worked in Australian dollars, the French franc, British pound, the peso, South American currencies. During that period of time, I did extensive travel overseas. I would go, my father and I would go for a month at a time, go overseas, go to Europe and work. We worked in the French basin, do some oil and gas work for the French government. Swiss banking, I was in college during some of this time too. So we went to Switzerland, opened some Swiss bank accounts, learned how the Swiss banking worked. We worked in the Bahamas, worked in Panama. You heard about the Panama Papers coming out. So early in the 70s, Panama became a place to put capital. So we learned about how that works and made some contacts down there. We don't have those contacts anymore today, but we did have them back then. We had our precious metals depository operation where we were actually holding gold and silver for clients. And throughout the 70s, we published the newsletter called New Horizons for Investors. And as we researched these different aspects of the financial world, we would publish recommendations. We created new investment platforms in very many different and varied business sectors. So it was a great time for us because there wasn't a lot going on in the stock market. So we were doing, besides doing our stock analysis and identifying the new companies, we were watching Silicon Valley grow. And we're investing in Intel and the precursors to what is now today Google and Amazon before the internet really kicked off. But we saw the early trappings of the internet starting with email, and it was actually a dynamic time for us.
And so what types of deals did you manage in the 70s?
So in college, I broke into the oil and gas business as a professional. I actually became a professional oil and gas landman. Today, I'm a professional registered landman. I broke into the oil and gas business in the Austin Chalk. It's the Austin Chalk oil place started over near San Antonio. And as it was moving towards College Station where I was going to college, I started being a landman. My father came to me when I was late, early in my junior year and said, I changed majors three times by the time I was a junior. And I was studying economics at the time. And he came to me and said, I know you don't know what you want to do with the rest of your life. So if you'll meet me down at the courthouse, I'll give you some skills that will last you the rest of your life. So I met him the next morning and down at the Bryan College Station, Brazos County Courthouse, and we started doing land work. And he taught me about how to do land work. And this was in 1978.
What is a landman and what is land work?
A landman is someone who goes out and buys oil and gas leases. If you build a pipeline, you have to do precursor work to buy the right-of-ways for that pipeline to go across somebody's farm. The landman goes out and executes that. He will go out and find out who owns the land and go find them and negotiate a price, so much a foot, so much a rod for this pipeline that's going to go up the east side of your farm. And we're going to start this pipeline next year. And I need an option. I need a right of way to come across your farm. And we're going to pay you so much an acre for that. We did work in the Bryan Woodbine, which is a big play coming in from the east into College Station. A huge oil and gas field. We worked in East Texas, I learned a lot about the Gulf Coast. My father had grown up in the Gulf Coast, so he taught me a lot about the Gulf Coast. As I said earlier, I operated a pipeline during this period of time. We were actually doing research into cable systems. Cable was becoming one of the huge, what we call cash cows during that period of time. And we also witnessed the first horizontal drilling on land. And that was in 77, 78, and 79 in the Austin Chalk. We had been drilling horizontal wells offshore for a decade or more, but they had never mechanically drilled a horizontal well onshore. So the first onshore drilling of the horizontal wells happened in the Austin Chalk. I actually drilled my first oil well as an oil and gas operator. It was in Ranger, Texas, and it was a Wildcat well. We were looking for Mississippi Reef. I did that under the tutelage of my father. He taught me how to drill wells during that period of time, and I learned a tremendous amount during that decade. We continued work on our 30,000 acre lease block in the San Juan Basin, northern part of the San Juan Basin. We continually did public research into public stocks, did research into pink sheet stocks, initial public offerings. We made quite a lot of money in initial public offerings during that period of time. And we continued to publish our New Horizons newsletter. So that was a dynamic time for us.
What was the strong suit of your team during the 70s?
Well, it continues to be the same strong suit we have today. We do mosaic type research. Today we're doing a different type of research. I'm not really researching public companies, although I watch them quite avidly. I don't really research them like I used to. During the 70s, we were researching over 2,000 public stocks a month. And actually that research took the form of, during that period of time, it was really before personal computers really came out and were programmed to do stock research. So we were doing research by hand. And as I said in our last episode, I was actually posting daily charts. And on the 200 stocks that we were most interested in, I would post them daily. And I would go through the Wall Street Journal every morning, and I would read the Wall Street Journal, and I would post the stock prices to the 200 most active stocks that we liked, what we considered to be the strongest stocks. They had a relative strength high above 75, which means that the stock was growing at a tremendous rate. I would do 200 of those a day, and actually I did that like 4 days a week. And then on the fifth day of the week, I would go through and plot weekly charts on another 200 stocks. And then we would look at every month when our charts came in at the first of the month, we would look at over 2,000 stocks. So I was monitoring over 2,000 stocks a month during that period of time. And we would recommend one or two in our newsletter. So out of 2,000, I was looking at every month, and my father and I would look together and we would talk about the stocks and we would talk about their ratios and talk about how they worked. And we would recommend one or two purchases a month as a general rule. We would research private equity investments, real estate, gold and silver, Forex trades. We did a lot of work in the medical devices world. When magnetic resonance imaging came out, that really caught our eye, and we started doing research into that. Real estate developments, we did research into mining. Data management was becoming big because computers were starting out. My first programming experience was learning how to program in COBOL in 1976 at Texas A&M. And I also learned how to program in BASIC during that period of time. BASIC came out a little later. We did in-depth research into why the economy was acting the way it was. I was studying economics at A&M, and we studied stagflation just almost weekly. We would study why the things are happening in stagflation and whether trickle-down economics would actually work, and we did quite a lot of that. So we came out of this decade with our mantra still being the same. That is, if you research 1,000 deals a year that you think are really strong deals and you find one or two or maybe three that you consider to be stellar, state-of-the-art type investments, then you've hit a home run. And you've done your job. It's hard work. You've done your research. You've done your job. And now you've got the fruits of that labor to go take advantage of. And that's where we stand today.
Awesome. So if you guys want more information about today's topic, go to customprivateequity.com. There are a number of resources there, as well as multiple ways to contact Paul. And once again, that URL is customprivateequity.com. Any final words, Paul?
No, Ron, thanks for your time today, and I appreciate you being here.